You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast, and incomprehensibly, it is now 2021. I think that might even be the first time I've said that out loud. No, I think I would normally say 2021, which is why it seems strange to my mouth. I'm a little bit rusty, forgive me. We've had several weeks off, but we've got some cracking content coming up. Just later this week, I'm speaking to Russell Kane. We have a fantastic interview with Tom Neenan in the can, and this is the fabulous Jordan Brooks. So, what can I tell you about Jordan? He is the winner and current holder, 3 years later, of the Edinburgh Comedy Award, due to the fact that there have been no further Edinburgh festivals. And we will talk, I tell you what, in the insiders stuff, we'll find out about Jordan's feelings about that, because for someone who is as kind of, let's not say iconoclastic, but what he really excels at is he really observes the observers. And what you'll find out throughout this interview is that he has an incredible knack for not just willful contrarianism, but for stepping back and seeing what's actually going on. Lots of us observe what's going on in our lives. He kind of observes himself observing you see what I mean? Oh, I've already tripped myself up. Listen, I'm not going to pretend to you that this one isn't a bit pretentious. I encourage Jordan to be pretentious, and I take all of the credit for that. This is some deep, deep ComCom here. So I'd even go so far as to say, if this is your first try of the podcast, maybe open with something a bit lighter. There will be, in the Insiders Club stuff, we're going to find out a bit more about Jordan's feelings about winning the Comedy Award. We're going to find out a bit more about the sort of the cultural race to expose more and more weakness and suffering over which comedy seems currently to obsess. And we are going to talk to Jordan about making Bleed, which was the show he did in which everyone in the audience wore those silent disco headphones, which was an incredible piece of comedy slash theatre. And by his own account, as you'll see in the Insiders Club extra bits, incredibly fucking difficult. Oh, that reminds me, not just a warning for swearing, there is some stuff we talk about. I'm not going to get into exactly what it is, but let's regard this as having a generalized content warning. If you are the sort of person who likes to take advantage of content warnings, then allow me to give you a generalized one. We're going to get into some, not deep into, but we're going to touch on some slightly difficult stuff. And let's just call that a generalized content warning to be on your toes. That's fair. I think that's fair. All of the extra bits you can get from comedianscomedian.com/insiders, along with the recent Q&A, private insiders Q&A with James Acaster. It's a lot of fun there as well. So with that in mind, here's Jordan Brooks. This is a good one. I'll do a proper here's Jordan Brooks in a second. I just love this conversation. It's pretty intense in parts, and it's really honest. And he's also very good at framing, like, he doesn't play the victim, and he really frames the difficult elements of his life as not him creating, or he's aware at least that in describing his life he's framing a narrative of it. Listen, there's we've just got to dive in. Here's Jordan Brooks.
Well, I went up to the Edinburgh Fringe in maybe 2008 for the first time, and I went on my own. And I hadn't started comedy at this point. I just really liked comedy, and I'd been making these little videos on YouTube of this character, and that was my only kind of foray into performance. And I'd written some scripts, and I kind of thought I'm going to do I'm going to do some comedy. I'm going to be like a comedy script writer or something. But I didn't really know it. I didn't know in what capacity, and I didn't know, you know, I didn't know how I'd even go about doing that. But I went to the Fringe, and I was there for like 3 days on my own, and it was raining the whole time, and I just ran from show to show to show, and I saw Hans Taven, this Dutch comic. And I remember that was the lasting impression, coming away thinking, well, that was mental, and I don't know what it was that I watched. And I remember just being so excited by the feelings it brought out in me, and the confusion and the room splitting. You know, there's one person sat one side of me giggling hysterically, and there's another person tutting out of sheer angry confusion. Mm. And I remember thinking, that's perfect. That's sort of what you want. But he was coming at it from like, it had its own internal logic. Even the maddest stuff had its own, you know, it was built from somewhere that you could kind of understand, but also couldn't. And part of the joy was in trying to figure out just what it was being said, if anything. And I thought, that's really fun. And then, but I also really loved mainstream comedy. I really loved, you know, I really like Michael McIntyre. I know, I know you might think that's a joke, but it's, I really like, you know, I really like Louis C.K. I really liked a lot of, like Jack D was one of my favorite comics growing up. And so I liked comedy. I liked the formula of comedy. And I think when I started, I thought, well, what can I do that is, for me, is not necessarily deconstructing the form, because that's not interesting to me or audiences, I think. But what is interesting is finding a way of making stand-up work for me as a form. And what I realized early on was that I would be writing stuff according to this sort of persona that I guess I had kind of... So initially, yeah, there were these odd bits and pieces. There were these strange things, like odd set pieces and perhaps less formulaic bits. But I was also trying to squeeze myself into a persona of like the sort of nerdy, socially awkward outsider. And I hit a real brick wall because I'd get about 10 minutes in. So there was this competition called the Welsh Unsigned Stand-Up Award, which Matt Rees won 1 year, Taylor Glenn, Charlie Webster also won it, Simon Emmanuel, like some really good people. And really nice, it was a nice sort of unifying, it was our only competition. It was our only sort of, you know, it was like our kind of World Cup. Yeah. And I won the award in 2012, so it was like 2 years in. And then the prize was to perform at the Glee Club. You get a paid weekend at the Glee Club, which at the time is like incredible to think of now, considering how hard it is, considering they won't book me now. They gave me a paid slot, and the slot was 15 minutes. The competition was 8 to 10 minutes slots. And so after 8 to 10 minutes, all I had... So basically, I sort of entered the competition in 2011, and it was like I'd been going for like 3 months, 4 months or something. And it was mad stuff. And it was all very like, almost like, so Charlie kept telling me, it's almost like one-liners, but the one-liners are observational and the one-liners are like harsh truths and stuff. And it's sort of, it's kind of like a monologue. And this is when Kiri Pritchard-McLean saw me as well. We were at the same heat and she, you know, vouched for me loads after that and sort of got me, you know, got me gigs in Manchester and stuff. But they felt like it was too nuts. It's like a year on, I went in sort of, I guess, like honing it a bit more in the direction of a fixed persona. But after the 8 to 10 minutes of this kind of awkward, I'm unconfident with women sort of thing, I didn't know where else to go because I felt like, all right, that may be like one facet of who I am, but it also feels like it's not at all. I was like, but I'm pretty confident in social situations and I've got a girlfriend. Why am I pretending that these things aren't the case? And so after the 8 to 10 minutes, all I had left was this set piece where I invited an invisible man onto the stage and he would perform and I would sit on the side of the stage watching and reacting to him. And then I'd get really frustrated with him. Then I'd call him my absent father. Then we'd wrestle. Then we'd fuck. Then I would try and bury the body. And I did it at the Glee Club at this paid weekend. And I had my top off. And I'd be dragging this invisible corpse through the crowd, getting people up to help me carry the corpse. And it was such a gear shift that people were, like, angry. And I don't even think they were angry because of the bit. They were just angry because of the sharp turn that it took to think, oh, we know who this guy is. And then suddenly, no, we don't. To the point where when they announced at the end of the night, they'd go, give it up for all your acts, such and such, Jordan Brooks, everyone booed. But I remember coming away thinking, well, that's better. That's that is better than the I'm quiet at parties bullshit that I was peddling. So I kind of realized that I perhaps, and I think I had I was trying to fit my persona into what I thought people wanted within, you know, I think this is why competitions can be a little bit not dangerous, but they can certainly shape your act in a way that ultimately isn't necessarily helpful, because it stifles the nuance. You know, when you do competitions and you're trying to strip things down to a short spot to fit everything in, you take away all of the fun little details, you take away all the quirks, and you try and streamline it, and you end up being, you know, trying to present yourself as neatly and as cleanly as possible. And for me, that just wasn't reflective of who I was, and it's not reflective of who people are. So I think the kind of early noughties stand up, the kind of Live at the Apollo, Michael McIntyre's Roadshow, did a real number on people's development, because it made them think that comedy had to be a particular way. And you see it now that I think that's starting to ebb away. And there were a lot of acts that I'd meet and still kind of meet where they go, I don't feel like I'm being funny on, like, my funny self on stage. And then you see them and you go, well, yeah, because you're talking in these, you're adopting these forms that are so familiar to us that you think stand-up has to slot into. But it's not what you think is funny. And that was, and I think that was sort of what I realized, was I have to make it as complicated as possible in terms of presenting myself in all of my contradictions, and but also doing stuff that would make me laugh.
I think that, I mean, that's really well put. That is typically articulate. I think I was going to ask, what, you know, why did you start off selling the line of bullshit? And I get what you're saying about the opponent. Is it that you were as subject to the idea of this is what a comedian is supposed to do as anyone else?
Yeah.
So you did that for a bit. And I guess your version of doing that would have still been nuanced and intelligent, and
it was still on the alternative side, yeah.
Yeah, right.
But it was definitely sort of with an eye to making sure that I didn't alienate audiences. But I do really think it helped me, as I say, in the sort of development, because it's still my, you know, I still want to connect to as many people as possible. As I say, I think that to me is a greater challenge than coming out and just doing something unrelentingly and alienatingly insane and enjoying the three people in the room that get it. That's too easy.
Oh, that's great. That's such a good answer. I don't have a jumping off point from that, because you really answered that question. I'm kind of wrestling with this idea of you as, not wrestling with it, but the idea of you as kind of mainstream, given that in your most recent show, which was I've Got Nothing, which I saw at the ARG Festival, that fucking show, before it even went to Edinburgh and when everyone else got on board, that it has genuine risk, and you're playing games and you're playing with the idea of games, and it's intelligent and there's stuff to work out, but it isn't alienating to people who aren't there.
Yeah, totally.
You know? Like, there's a puzzle to unravel here, and I can feel smart, I can feel clever with myself for getting it early and all the, you know, that kind of stuff. But then even then, you're just wrong-footing me all over the place and outmaneuvering the audience and stuff. That type of thing, you said earlier on, the Glee won't book you. Presumably there are other people who won't book you, and there are other, like, have you got an idea of the sort of the TV opportunities which other people with your success would maybe have open to them that you don't feel are open to you?
Or do you feel like
do you know what I mean? Someone in the Facebook group said a bit, or on Twitter recently, said something about Dictionary Corner on 8 out of 10 Cats, and their point was like, why isn't the person on Dictionary Corner funny? And of course the answer is, you know, it's a different tone and it's a different opportunity for different sorts of acts to what you, the tweeter, are used to. But do you know what I mean? Like, do you have a sense of like, oh, by going down this road, and by being committed to the weirdness and the intelligence and doing what it is that I like, and what you're doing, what it is that you find funny. Have you closed to, or do you feel you've closed?
I think about it a lot, but I don't know really, because I think I have, for some people, I have perhaps a reputation for being too alternative. So like there are clubs that'll be too scared to book me because they might consider me too much of a potential room splitter. I would obviously argue that rarely happens. You know, I actually don't die that often, but I have the impression, I think, of someone who probably is either, you either get it or you don't. Actually, most people do get it, but people want to feel like they're in on the joke and it's cool. And some people don't get it. And that's kind of part of the appeal. Actually, most people get it. There are some clubs, yeah, there was a club, I won't name it, but I was emailing back and forth with some small club in like South London. And I was like, can I come do, and this is after I'd won the award. And I was like, can I come do a slot? And they went, yeah, yeah. Can you do, could you come and just do like a 5-minute tryout spot just before we test whether, because they're quite middle class. And I just stopped replying because I was like, well, fuck you then. I don't know what to say to you. You know, either book me or don't. I'm not going to. If you're that worried, then I'm sorry, I'm not gonna venture down to Sydenham. Yeah. Oops. yeah. But do I think it has limited my opportunities? Honestly, I don't know. Because I think that the sort of TV industry, or the kind of, you know, the sort of higher up people, they still do want to champion new acts and different acts. And so there's an eagerness, sure, there's a hunger to like get me on things, but I do think there is a hesitance because they don't quite know how my act will translate to. But what we're talking about here is like panel shows, right? That's all we're talking about, because that's the only shows that are available to people. I think I am at the bottom of the list of priority. You've got your sort of straight white cis men who are dependable and they know what they're getting. And then you've got me. I'm not going to supersede those men. And I'm certainly not going to be prioritized over anyone who doesn't fit into that category. So
yeah,
I'm not too sort of, I do think, oh, if I was asked to do these shows, of course I would do them. But I also don't think that I would necessarily do a better job than anyone else. So why bother putting me on?
And have you done Apollo?
No. Why did you think I'd done Apollo?
Well, I'm making sure that I don't go, I think you'd be great on Apollo, and that you reply,
yeah, thanks, mate.
Apollo.
I died on my arse. I tweeted about
it. And I expose a hole in my research. And I could really see you on that stage, but at the same time, I can't see the decision being made.
That's exactly it. I think I can see how it would work. I can see how it would be fine. But it is just about, yeah, it's just about persuading people to take that punt. I mean, they did it with Spencer Jones. They did it with Nick Helm, although I guess he didn't have a great experience. Not that you would know from the final edit, unless you pour over the footage like I did. And you can see some people in the background leaving. but generally, I think, yeah, people are, I mean, it's, yeah, that's televised stand-up. Like, it's, again, it comes back to that prejudging what an audience will like and won't like. And I've never thought I wouldn't have some broader appeal that exceeds people's expectations.
Let's have a look through your back catalogue, because the things that you've done, I don't think I've seen every show of yours. I saw the first one, I remember the sweeping one, and I saw I think the next one of yours I saw was the one in the awful, awful Fringe venue, where like for the first week of the festival, you were in the worst room imaginable.
Body of work.
Like a body of work. And that was like, God, I had a lot of respect for you. That was one of those big heroic Mike Bubbins style comedy things where you go, oh, this guy's committing to it, despite this being absolutely unplayable.
Yeah.
That show was, I've been sort of refreshing my memory by looking back at some of the reviews of that show, which is sort of arguably pointless, but, you know, they remind me of some of the things I thought at the time. And I love the game of announcing yourself at the beginning of the show. And I loved, I can think of some of the component parts of that show. I think I saw someone describe it as, oh, the show is a pastiche, or the show turns out to be a pastiche of worthy shows where comedians, you know, trade off the death of a relative. And I remember reading that and think, like, this morning and thinking, oh, was it? I don't know if I got
that. I don't
think
it is. I mean, it certainly... how disingenuous am I being when I say that? I had definitely seen shows of that type, and I thought, this is bullshit. You're manipulating us into getting a particular response. At the time, I was really obsessed with, and couldn't stop rewatching, the Ricky Gervais series, Derek, because I was so fascinated by how kind of manipulative it was, by how much it was just button pushing. It was just sort of announcing sad things at you, universally sad things, and expecting us to respond. You know, it was like sort of watching a series of sort of sad emojis. You know, there was nothing. It's very like, can watch it on your phone on the commute to work. Don't need to think about it. Here's someone crying. Oh no, an old person's died. Oh, I remember when an old person in my life died. Now I'm crying on the tube. It just felt so easy. And I was like, but that isn't what grief is. That isn't what our response should be. Why are you making us want to feel that thing? And I was just really fascinated by that. I was also interested in how, generally, how we sort of have to, how hard we have to work to get someone's sympathy. Not in comedy, not on stage, but just in general in life. How we have to sell a story, we have to sell our trauma, we have to sell our tragedy in order for people to kind of feel something for us. And I thought that's a really fun tool of manipulation. But it was also because there were shows about mental health that I felt were, again, very direct, very like, I have depression and here's my experience of depression. And I kept thinking, but I think I know what my sort of the state of my mental health is. I'm starting to understand it. I'm, you know, it's still very much like unknown. Why would I come out and talk in such concrete terms? Why not come out and reflect that uncertainty, reflect the panic? And so, yeah, I think it was like, I was just really interested in why stand-up still felt like such a juvenile form when it came to its like the what it wanted from an audience. And just how simple and basic it can be at times. There's so much telling and not showing. There's so much telling. And I thought, well, why not just show people what you experience, or, you know, sweep people into that world, make them experience these things, and then kind of reveal what it was about, or hint at what it was about. So it was about trying to strike the right balance so that I wasn't stopping at 50 minutes and going, hey guys, so what you've just been watching is a reflection of generalized anxiety disorder. You know, it was more. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't shortchanging the audience and just giving them a big middle finger. So the show was ostensibly about. It was me trying to do a show about my nan and talk about her story, her life, and then that being sabotaged, and me kind of leading the audience down the garden path in terms of them thinking that it's about dementia and that I'm trying to reflect the experience of having dementia. Turns out that that's just a manipulative tool to get people to connect with my real problem, which is that, you know, I have OCD. And I wanted to make sure, and initially I was going to leave it for ages, making the audience think that I was talking about my nan having dementia. But in previews, I just couldn't go through with it, because obviously you have to factor in, well, people have actually legitimately had experiences that are going to be, you know, this is going to be triggering for them, and you have to respect that. And so as it sort of went on, the show became the period between me saying my nan had dementia and this is what it was about, or at least implying it was about, and the reveal that it wasn't became seconds, mere seconds, because I couldn't deal with the idea of really upsetting people. So it was fun. It was interesting to, like, I guess it's also a sort of cake and eat it show where you're kind of taking the piss out of the things that you are also using to get a response out of the audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the phrase cake and eat it had kind of appeared to me. Yeah, because you get to employ those tactics and then go, but aha. But you still get to ride high from the...
Totally. And I think that's sort of the point, is like, it's about that... Yeah, I mean, I guess like a lot of my act is about self-expression and about the line between sincerity and insincerity and how hard it is to put it into words what you feel, and then let alone get people to connect with it. And how we do often have to go down these very, very sort of narrow routes, a la Ricky Gervais's Derek, to get people to emote. And so that was like, I was really interested in that.
Something I think you're really good at is not following the most obvious take on something. Like, I think that's part of why I really enjoy your Twitter output. You're really good at like, and maybe we should get into Dogecoin.
Yeah, let's get into Doge.
Like, you're really good at, and ultimately an element of it is simply observational comedy, except you're really good at taking a step back and observing the people who are trying to observe the thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a bit meta. Like, you tweeted the other day, frantically scanning the Boris photo for where I could Photoshop Bernie into, tears forming in my eyes, jaw clenched, feeling connected yet appallingly alone. Like, the fucking hell! That you've just nailed that feeling. Like, not that I've ever desperately, you know, burst into tears whilst trying to form a meme, but the idea of that connected yet appallingly alone, trying to join in with a thing, that's such a kind of... I don't know if it's a meta observation, or the meta-ness of it is probably just because it's an observation about the people who are going through that. I mean, it's just an observation ultimately, but it's just distance slightly. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think for sure. I definitely have felt that distance, and that sort of that distance that I felt from the world is something that I felt really, you know, in my sort of late adolescence, early 20s. I was very much detached and removed, and I felt like I was really on the sidelines. And it made me very kind of a bit snide and a bit removed and a bit hard to connect with, I think. And so that part of me, I think, is still kind of there. I still sort of have that. But it's also a kind of willful contrarianism of like, of going, no, fuck you, I'm going to do something. I'm going to do the opposite of this thing. But yeah, I don't know if it's sort of, I'm not sure if it is meta. Because, and again, I mean, this is sort of what I think sometimes reviews of my stand-up are focused too much on, which is the meta element and the postmodern element and the, oh, he's reflecting on stand-up itself. It's like, I'm not. That's like a byproduct. That's like what just, I guess that's what it turns out to look like. But actually the pursuit for me is to do something that feels more truthful. You know, you do see stand-ups who sort of take the piss out of Michael McIntyre or take the piss out of observational comedy, and it's so boring. It's so boring. It's so self-regarding. I think more what my intention is to do something that for me feels more of a truthful expression of what it means to be a person or what it means for me to be me. It just happens to perhaps not fit within the confines. But I think that's everyone, right? That's all stand-up, is that we're all trying to squeeze ourselves into a sort of little boxes. And it isn't real. It's very inauthentic. And there was definitely a period around the sort of, the kind of early noughties, or late early noughties, where stand-up did feel very regimented and did feel very inauthentic. Mm. And... you know, there'd be these sort of like stock phrases that people would use where they'd sort of go, well, then this person said the funniest thing I've ever heard, or, you know, my dad is the angriest man alive. Here's some examples. And it felt, once you start, and even if the audience aren't necessarily acknowledging that consciously, I think once they start to hear all of this stuff, it just makes you switch off ever so slightly and feel a slight disconnect from the act. So that for me was like, I guess I was kind of pushing against that. More than stand up, but like the expression within stand up. I feel like I've talked myself into saying actually it is quite meta and self regarding. But
yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit. Yeah, it looks like you're taking the piss out of stand up, because what you're taking the piss out of is the self regard, the sort of crystallized self regard of stand up.
Yeah.
That is quite meta.
It is quite meta, I guess. But metaness
isn't the point. It's not like you're doing it in order to be meta.
No. I'm not doing it for comedy fans. I'm doing it because I think that I think that what I'm doing is more authentic. It's the pursuit of authenticity.
And that's the distance I was talking about. Like, yeah. rather than do an impression of a comedian that might seem jaded or hack, what you're interested in is kind of a step removed of that and go, why do we all do those impressions? What's it really about?
Yeah, totally. And also it's just about doing something different. It's just about doing something that excites me and something that I would want to watch. And, you know, as I say, it's about making myself laugh, really.
Just on authenticity, can you think of times when you have been inauthentic? Have you caught yourself being inauthentic?
Oh, all the time.
On stage?
Yeah, totally. All the time.
And I know you personally, so let's say on stage.
It was definitely like, I mean, that's part of the fascination, isn't it? Of the sort of, where is the dividing line? Can we ever be sincere? Is what, you know, when you say something, it immediately is constructed. On stage, even more so. So for me, it's like, yeah, there are times when I feel like I'm being inauthentic, but for me, it's not about going, well, that's a bad thing that needs to be removed. Well, why do I feel it inauthentic at that point? What is it that I said that made me feel like I wasn't being me? What is me? How do I build that into the show then? How do I structure it around the uncertainties so that even the inauthenticity, even the insincerities feel like they are a deliberate device in a way? So it's just kind of like sucking everything into the orbit, you know?
Yes, that's great. I mean, what's fascinating about that is the... I think in comedy, the main route to finding funny things is that the problems are the material, right? Clowny thing. The problems are the material. Mm-hmm. And for some people, that means this object won't respond in the way it wants to, or I don't fit into the world. And for you, I think the problem from which you derive the most material is precisely what you've just described, which is, I feel something about this thing I've just said. Why do I do that? That's the problem, isn't it? So let's explore that. Let's find the material in that problem.
Because that's reflective of a problem of self-expression, or that you know, hitting a brick wall is the thing. And there's always funny in failure. There's always funny in failure. I would rather watch someone fail to execute something they intend to do rather than succeed in terms of comedy. And it's about building that into the show. So you sometimes see it with certain shows will have like a blurb that they've written in advance because they've decided, well, this show is going to be about this thing.
Yeah.
And they haven't worked out how to make it funny because maybe it isn't actually funny. Maybe the audience don't care about your mum being ill or whatever. And you have to work. And so you go, well, audience is indifference. Maybe that's built into the way that I tell that story. And so it's about leaving it open. And so every sort of blurb I've written for a show is I've tried to keep it as open as possible so that even down to the last minute before the Edinburgh Fringe or even during it, I'm still moving things around and changing it because it is evolving in response to how much the audience will let me get away with, how I am learning to express myself or whatever. It's just about building all of the responses into the final product. Because you can have a very fixed idea of what you want to do, but that doesn't mean the audience are going to want it. And if the audience don't want it, tough shit, you're going to have to adapt.
So this is Jordan. There are about 35 more minutes of this, if you can cope with it, and I certainly can. This is peak ComCom as far as I'm concerned. All available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, including his mixed feelings about winning the Comedy Award and the inside story of the creative process behind Bleed. And on that subject, you can actually get hold of Bleed for digital download, as well as I've Got Nothing. I made notes, right? After I saw, I alluded to it, but you won't hear the edit because Nathan's excellent. But I actually read, Jordan, the notes that I'd made when I saw I've Got Nothing at the ARG Festival. And because I was so, so blown away and I was frantically going, remember that bit, remember that bit, remember that bit. If you would like to enjoy that show yourself, go to Jordan's website, which is jordanbrookscomedy.com. And you can download Bleed, you can download I've Got Nothing. There's tons of clips on there. So if you are as much of a fan / obsessive of his work as I am, then do go there. And you can follow him at Jord Brooks on Twitter. God damn it, I'm only just remembering now. We didn't even get into the fun he had when he got blue-ticked and started changing his name on Twitter and saying all sorts of fun things. Not to worry, another time. That's all of that. What am I touting? Normally this is for me to tell you about gigs and stuff. Precious few of them, but there is one coming up. I'll tell you when that is. It's in March. I'm doing 1 p.m. on Saturday, the 20th of March. It's an online gig for Catherine Bohart's brilliant Gigless show. She is doing a comedy festival, which probably is it's probably called the Gigless Comedy Festival or something like that. I should know, but I don't. But you can find out all about that by following the Twitter of this show, at ComComPod. But it is 1 p.m. March the 20th, or just, you've got the details. There's a thing. It's me doing a preview. There's loads of great people doing a preview. And Catherine Bohart is organising it. So put all of those in Google and find it. You know, you can cope with that, I'm sure. So there's that to tell you about. And then the other things are just comedyinsights.com and virtualofficeparty.co.uk, which are the fun things I'm continuing to do, even though it isn't Christmas. Unique concepts left, right and centre, keeping me not just happily afloat, but also kind of mad and obsessed in a way that I'm quite enjoying. Speaking of mad and obsessed, let's go back to this chat with Jordan Brooks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I want to talk about, with reference to that show and more broadly, I want to talk about the idea of vulnerability, because you're someone who, simply by taking the risks on stage that you take, you make yourself vulnerable to the stuff not working, to the stuff being too personal, to the stuff being, like, I imagine there's a kind of family risk when you're kind of miming graphically sexual things with members of your family. There's presumably you need to have an eggy conversation with a parent at some point. I mean, maybe you don't. You know, like this. But we'll get maybe to touch on that in a minute. But that idea of risk, that idea of vulnerability, of putting yourself in a position where you can be judged unfavorably by audiences, other people, family, friends, you know, those kind of things. That's really key to what you do, I think, making yourself vulnerable. It's hard to imagine a show of yours in which you didn't make yourself vulnerable somehow.
Yeah. I think it is. Yeah, no, you're right. I do. I do that, actually. I mean, it's a hard navigation, right? It's like, I've only really been doing, I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years. I've done 5 shows. It's a drop in the ocean in terms of development. And so I'm still learning what my own boundaries are and what I am comfortable with putting on stage or what I'm comfortable with saying in, like, on podcasts like this. You know, there's a sort of, you're constantly learning what is and isn't healthy for you. There are times when it's been too raw and too vulnerable, and I've been badly stung by it. So it's about, it is about finding the balance, and it is hard sometimes to accept that, oh, people will watch this and fucking hate me. They will fucking hate me for this. They'll hate me for saying what I've said. They'll hate me for the way that I've approached it. They'll hate the way I made them feel uncomfortable. And there are times when that does bother me, for sure. But I think as time goes on, I do sort of toughen up a little bit. And it's also about setting the boundary in my head where I go, well, that's not me. You know, it's what I'm doing on stage. And also, it is deliberately, I'm aware it's going to piss people off. I'm aware it's going to wind people up and push their buttons. So I can't be surprised if I actually get that result. But it's been, it's a sort of, I'm still figuring it out, really. I'm still figuring out what my own boundaries are. In terms of sort of family members, I mean, they sort of get it. I mean, I'm quite fortunate that my mum comes from a sort of theatery background. I mean, my nan was an actor. My granddad worked at the BBC. And so, you know, my mum grew up in a very arty kind of world, and my dad is very, you know, sort of artistically minded. He was very briefly an actor. He was in Brookside, like the first three episodes of Brookside, and he's a, you know, a good sort of, yeah. So they both sort of weren't discouraging. And I think you can sometimes see when parents have really done a number on their kids by dissuading them from pursuing a career that perhaps isn't going to be fruitful, and, you know, at least financially. And it's going to be full of ups and downs. I feel very fortunate that they haven't ever said, you shouldn't do this. And I do think that support has allowed me to perhaps feel like I can take a sort of risk. They do get it. Yeah. I mean, I think my, you know, obviously my parents, my dad's never seen me, but my mum has seen every show I've done. And I think over time has come to accept that this is just what I do. And not all of it's going to be for her, but actually a lot of it is. A lot of it she really likes, and a lot of it she really enjoys. And, you know, I think the most recent show I did, the I've Got Nothing, was the one that upset her the most. Because it felt like a real sort of bellow into the void. And I think she knows where I've come from. You know, she knows that it's taken me a long time to get to a place where I would even leave my bedroom, let alone step on stage. So there's a mix of sort of pride that only she can really know and have, and also worry, because if I say something that seems a little bit too vulnerable or too raw, she will think it's, you know, a sort of worrying sign. But I think generally she's very pleased and very proud, and can see how it works, can see how it's working for me.
So her, almost in that kind of step back way again, her concern in watching you do that show is less to do with the very funny bits where you kind of act out attempting to seduce her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which one, you know, an outsider might think, well, how's his mum going to feel about that when she sees the work? And it's funny, hard now for me to hear the word cool without thinking of you going, cool. Trying to crack on to your mum while she's hovering.
Yeah. I mean, you know, during this pandemic, I've had to move back with her. How awkward do you think it is? I never thought I'd have to do this. Standing in the kitchen with her thinking, yep, this is where I imagined I'd be standing as I did this.
But it's like her concern for you is less to do with those apparently outrageous bits,
yeah,
and more to do with her seeing you making yourself vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure. I think the individual bits she's not too bothered about, because she understands that it's a device. And also she knows she's not watching me. She's not watching her son on stage. She's watching her son perform. She's watching a persona that is, all right, it's built up out of kind of cherry-picked aspects of me, I guess, or the worst parts of me, or the most anxious parts of me, and then put together. But it's also made up of other people. It's also made up of little flexes of, you know, little things that people have said that are quite vulnerable, or things that I've observed in people that I think are kind of sweet or weird, and just kind of put them in. So she knows she's watching a performance, but I think the more vulnerable moments, for sure, she can see her son. She'll never not see her son saying, you know, provocatively direct things about his mental health.
And I want to come back to persona and that kind of like that sort of collage aspect of the persona. I know you as a socially confident, very articulate, funny person. And I don't want to sort of skate over, you were saying about not being able to leave your room.
Mm-hmm.
So with kind of the caveats that we, you know, spoke about before at the beginning of this about not wanting to sort of push you into anywhere awkward for you, I haven't listened to the podcast that you did with Rich Wilson, Fabulous Rich, that my wife told me about. Did you know this? What's that about? Like, in as much as you want to kind of touch on it for now, like what was the inability to leave your room about?
It was a sort of snowball of things, really. Like most people, I had a pretty shitty time of it as a teenager. I had really bad skin, and it's very difficult to talk about this stuff because you feel like it's sort of you're telling a story. You know, you're selling a narrative of yourself. And again, it's that thing of being like, I have to be a victim here of circumstance in order for you to sympathise with me or to like me or whatever. You know, I was a bit of an obnoxious prick. I think I was difficult to deal with at times, particularly my friends, when they go, well, why is this guy being an arsehole? And obviously looking back, you go, well, because he was deeply insecure. But at the time, you just go, I don't know how to handle this guy. So sometimes I'd find that, like, you know, all of my friends had hung out without me and stuff like that. And it just sort of slowly I became a bit more removed and detached. And then I got really heavily into smoking weed and drinking. And then stopped going to college, dropped out, and then started again, went to a different college. That's where I met Charlie Webster, and I started to sort of rebuild a bit. And I cut my previous friends out because I just didn't feel like they were my friends anymore and hadn't been for a long time. And but then I really turned in on myself and became very, I was very obsessed with, like, writing. I was like, I'm going to be the reclusive writer type, you know, and I grew my hair out and I was just writing every day, all day. And it became really, really obsessional. And I would do some pretty dark things, which looking back is mad to think now. But I'd like, if I stood up from my computer, as in got bored of writing and would move away, I'd like punch myself in the face or like pinch myself or scratch myself. And I'd put signs up on my wall saying, don't leave your room, you know, all this stuff. I became really, like, really fiercely disciplined in a way that was, you know, very unhealthy, I guess. And the book I was writing was shit as well, so it wasn't worth it. And so, yeah, I just started to withdraw more and more. And then obviously my friends, so Charlie went off to university and I didn't, and I sort of lagged behind. And I really, I just became very, very obsessional, very, like, very obsessed with my looks and the way I looked. I'd constantly look at the mirror. I'd constantly sort of, you know, I'd get up and look at myself in the mirror and I'd try and work out if I was attractive or not. Sometimes I'd take the mirror out into the garden, into the outside, so I could judge it by natural light. Sometimes I'd get up and I'd count my spots. I'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then I'd sit back down and then I'd get back up and I'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I'd just keep counting them. And so I became really in my own head. And then it started, it wasn't like a bad place to be. I wasn't sort of, you know, I was having a kind of nice time in my head. I was, you know, I was very, my imagination would run wild and I was trying to write stuff and it felt like, I didn't feel like I was on the wrong path. It felt like this is just who I am. This is what I'm going to do. And then it just kind of went sour. You know, I started to, my brain sort of rebelled against me and I started to feel not safe in my own head at all. And the kind of obsessional, you know, being obsessed with productivity became obsessed with dark stuff or, you know, committing horrible acts and not being able, and then being so shocked by where that had come from. That would become the obsession. And so then I decided, okay, I'm going to have to go to university. I'm going to have to get out and do something because I'm, you know, something's really wrong here. And I went to uni and I went to Newport and I did English for 2 years and then slowly slipped away. And I started to really, I mean, then at that point, I still didn't really know, really didn't understand OCD. I still didn't understand what it was, but I was starting to get a kind of idea of it. I'd been to see a therapist, I'd been to doctors, I'd talked to them about all this stuff and they sort of, you know, led me down that route. But then I had to drop out of uni and then went back and did animation and finished the degree. I think then that was when I started to kind of build a life for myself. I lost my virginity, so then I felt a lot more confident then, but I was like 24 at this point. And so it was a sort of slow climb into normality, but from a place of where previously I'd been so removed, so kind of like snide, you know, so as I said earlier, like so on the sidelines, so critical, so hypercritical. And I think I just, I kind of loosened up as I went along. So the last sort of 10 years, excuse me, have been me becoming what I felt like, as a normal person. But it's taken years, and it's taken being on meds, it's taken exercising regularly, making good choices, and learning to live with a lot of it as well, just learning to get on with it. But it did sort of make me feel like a victim. You know, it made me feel like a real victim and someone who had a lot of things happen to them. And it took me a while to not feel like the victim of something, and to feel like... because I think it's an interesting time that we're in, where we are sort of obsessed with victimhood and assigning victimhood, and I do think it's helpful in some ways, and in other ways I think it closes us off from acknowledging our own active participation in things and our own responsibility. And I definitely think that sort of victimhood was so entrenched in me that it's been hard for me to acknowledge that I have the capacity to be a bit of a dick, and that's okay. And actually, that's just part of being a human being, and not something to be like beating yourself up with and ruminating on and over and over. So there's still a bit of a fallout in terms of the way that my brain functions. But I'm definitely better, definitely in a far better place than I ever thought was conceivable, certainly back then.
I was reading something about intrusive thoughts recently, and about how, because I don't know if I have intrusive thoughts, but I think the fact that I wonder if I do means I probably do. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those things where you go, oh, you know, we never know how anyone else sees the world. And one of the things that I found was so, like, I felt like, oh, that's a weight off my shoulders, is the idea, as posited in this book, that that the fact that you are recognising the awfulness of a negative thought that you're having, like, you know, a notion about whatever it is, some sort of, and I'm guarding myself here by not exposing it, you know, but like the notion of doing something horrible to someone that you love, the fact that you recognize that makes you feel horrible is part of like why you shouldn't worry about it too much. Because if you have that thought and don't recognize that it's horrible, maybe then it's time to be a bit more concerned.
Yeah.
That kind of thing really struck me, like, oh God, that's a good, I don't know what the word is, not a mantra, but some sort of an elegant little thought that makes you go, oh yes, the fact of that means it's okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Were there any kind of similar things on that kind of journey back to yourself, which it seems to have been so successful that I didn't know any of it, and I've known you socially for a while, and I've seen your work as well, you know, which alludes to some of those things, but not in a way that plays that kind of victimhood thing and says, well, it's, you know, it's about me.
Well, even with the sort of way that I've outlined my story there, it feels like it's, you know, I don't want you to think that I'm presenting myself as a victim. It's just circumstantial, isn't it? You know, it's just what happens. But it does contribute to the way to I guess sort of the way that I have, you know, I am. It is there. What was your question? Sorry, I'm just suddenly very preoccupied with not looking like I'm trying to lead people into thinking I'm a.
I don't think you are at all. I think you've taken an admirable distance from those things and described in very sort of functional kind of terms, then this happened and I dealt with it like this. And, you know, I think that's one of the, that idea of taking responsibility for one's own thought process. Like I always think of it with my own kind of psychology. I think of it in my school. I hated school. Mm. And for years I blamed it for doing things to me and making me see the world in a particular way. And then a few years ago, I suddenly had this revelation that, oh, this kid that sat next to me in a lot of classes, or someone that I knew and who has a similar, well, you know, a very different take on life, he didn't mind it at all. Happiest days of his life. And I'm like, well, we were in the same room, how was that? Do you know what I mean? And you're recognizing, oh, I need to take a bit of responsibility for the lessons that I learned from things. Thing happened and I learned a particular thing from it, and I'm responsible for that. It's like a kind of it's one of those things. It's like, you know, you are who you love and not who loves you back. It's one of those things. You go, oh, that's a huge perspective shift that makes a big difference. I'm just wondering, in your piecing back together of yourself from those pretty dark times, not to kind of write them all off as, you know, I don't know where you are right now. You seem in a happier place. Happier place is a little trite, but there it is. Were there particular idioms or ideas or mantras that occurred to you in that same sort of way that you could share? Do you know what I mean? Like, as someone who seems to have pulled themselves back from the brink quite successfully, maybe one of those things is about taking responsibility. Maybe one of those things is about having an artistic outlet that you didn't have at that time.
Yeah, for sure. I think something that I went to therapy when I was 23, 24, and I saw this guy for like 6 weeks before I then went back to uni. And I always remember him saying, thoughts aren't facts. Thoughts aren't facts. And it's such an obvious thing. And it's so easily forgotten when you're caught up. And yeah, what you said about if you're worrying about something, then you're probably fine, I think is broadly true. If you're worrying about this stuff, you're so self-protective that you're not, there's no way you would do any of the things that you're worried about doing. And in fact, the fact that you have pointed it out, you know, it's like we've got a sort of stream of thoughts, and some of them are mad, some of them are incidental, some of them are trivial. But when like a mad thought occurs, some people fish that out and go, what is that? And interrogate it forensically. They don't understand why their brain would think, why would that occur to me? What does that say about who I am as a person? And then they can't let it go. They can't put it back in the stream. And I think it's, I think that there's a bit of science behind it in terms of chemicals in the brain, but I wouldn't want to say because I don't know. But there is some science in terms of like it's a chemical imbalance that makes us unable to let go, you know. And actually, there's something about ruminating on this thing and the ritual of that and the going over and over and over that actually generates a chemical that is absent in us, which is why I think meds have really helped, because I still have the impulse to go down this path. I still get those thoughts, but they just don't bother me as much. But I think it's also because I have built up a stronger sense of who I am. And that's just through getting older. That's just through, having a creative outlet. That's just through doing a lot of work and reflection, and also building. And this is the thing that I've gone back to therapy. So I was in therapy for for a few weeks, 10 years ago, and I've gone back to someone new, and it's genuinely been life-saving, you know, because I was in a bad place and I really didn't know what to do. So I felt like I had to go, but it's been really interesting in terms of identifying the time in my life when I felt very secure in myself, very secure in my world. And how that slowly ebbed away, that slowly felt like it was being poisoned by myself. And the work at the moment is to get back to that place where I feel like I am secure in my own world. And that means setting boundaries. That means not confessing all. That means not saying everything to everyone always. And so that does extend to my act and what I choose to put on stage. And that's not to say I'm shutting down and going mainstream, baby, but there's more of a mindful approach to what I am putting out there, and a greater amount of control, and how much that reflects having your own privacy, having your own private world. And it's definitely, you know, it informs the way that you approach relationships, or people approach relationships, where a lot of, you know, if you're insecure in your own world, you latch yourself onto someone else's world, and you seek that, you know, you can't have your own private, you don't have your own private space. So you just sort of go into someone else's, or you build one with someone else. And I've definitely had that impulse, you know, since I first had my kind of first serious relationship. I've not been single for extended periods because I think of that lack of being able to be alone with yourself.
In my untrained COD psychologist archetypal story smeller, kind of in that kind of, with that, wearing that hat, when you were talking earlier on about your feelings of vulnerability and feelings of distress at your skin and the fact that you felt ugly, and you were talking about that, and I wonder whether there is a response to that, a sort of a triumphant, an appropriation of those feelings, a reappropriation of those feelings in when you are being deliberately grotesque on stage. In the same way that comics people say, you know, you become a comedian to control the way you are laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a parallel there whereby you are controlled, you are controlling the your attractiveness?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I used to have a line in, I can't remember what show, but I think I cut it, where I said something like, I keep moving my face because if I stop, you'll see how ugly I am. And it wasn't funny, so I didn't keep it in. But there was something interesting in the fact of just keep moving like a shark, you know, just keep sort of keep distracting them. So it's definitely fed into the way that I perform, for sure. It's definitely in my act. I mean, in I've Got Nothing, there's a bit where I talk about my looks, and because it was a thing that I thought, well, no, I mean, this is one of the things where I thought, well, men aren't saying this on stage. They're not saying I think I'm ugly. And it defined so much of my life that I thought, well, why not put it on stage, and why not sit with that vulnerability? And yeah, as you say, own it and be with it and sit with it. And also the kind of, I mean, that show was full of lots of ambivalence and contradictions. You know, there was a sort of, it was upbeat, but it was downbeat. It was sort of, I was kind of feeling very suicidal, but I was also very buoyed in some ways. And I was happy, I was sad. You know, it was structureless and also structured, all these things. And I think it sort of played into that as well, going, well, I think I'm ugly, yet look how confident I am. I'm confidently telling you this thing. I'm looking you in the eyes and I'm telling you all of the things that people have said about my looks over the years that I have catalogued and never forgotten. But I'm doing it in pub. I'm doing it to a room full of 100 people. So it made sort of sense in terms of the show, but it's, yeah, I guess it was a sense of ownership of like, yeah. Yeah. Basically, I agree with you.
I didn't see I've Got Nothing at Edinburgh because I was busy swanking around having caught it early. At the end bit in I've Got Nothing at ARG was the game where you kept walking off and coming back when we clapped.
Mm. Yeah.
Was that the end in the show? Was that the final end?
It was an end. So that was how I was originally going to end the show. And then I did it. I did another preview and it just, the audience did not know if it was over or not, because it was in 2 North Down in London. It was in this sort of room where, you know, there's nowhere to go. If you're off the stage, you're just standing with the audience. And so I pretended so often that it was over that when I actually stepped down and started putting my shoes back on and putting my coat on and my bag to go, the audience are still sat there looking at me thinking it's part of the show. And I remember thinking, that's so fucking funny. And the sense of what's real and what's not real was just really, I was just really fascinated by. So I put that in. And so, no, the show doesn't end like that. The show ends seemingly like that at about 40, 45, 50 minutes. But then I cut. So what in Edinburgh, I would wait for a number of people to leave. And then I would come back out and say, all right, let's crack on. And I just carry on and do 10 more minutes to like half the audience. Right. Now, obviously, I like it would, how many people would leave would be according to how many people were preempting it, how many people believed it, how much I could hold my nerve. Some days I couldn't hold my nerve at all. And I would like, I'd let 2 or 3 people go. And then I'd be like, oh, no. Some days a third or half the audience would go.
Magnificent.
And then they try and come back in as well. And some of them got really angry as well. There was...
Oh, you wouldn't let them back in?
No, I wouldn't let them back in. Fuck them. The show's over for you. There was one bit which couldn't have gone more perfectly, where there was a couple. There was a man and a woman and their son on the front row. And I directed a lot of the seducing my mum stuff to them. Made them feel super uncomfortable. I mean, they were loving it, obviously. And then on the fake ending, the dad left and just left the mum and the son. And I sat down in front of them and went, "You're welcome." You're free to do as you please, my friends.
Andrew Frayne asks, It's a long question. It's basically, here we go. Be interested to hear about the process of creating something like I've Got Nothing, which gives the impression of being improvised, even slapdash, was in fact super tight. I saw it twice in Edinburgh for enjoyment and comparison. So just, I guess the question there is, how tight was the structure and how much were you deliberately giving the impression of it being loose when actually it was A to B to C?
It's really hard to know because the original intention was to keep the show super, super loose.
When I saw that thing, it really looked like you'd written it because you've got nothing.
Yeah.
You genuinely were like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And the idea was to just go, oh, look, I have to say, from the outside, it felt like, if you're not going to give me the award for Bleed, fuck you, I'm just going to turn up and do whatever.
That's kind of true. I mean, each show is a reaction to the previous show. And, in my own sort of way that amuses me and no one else. And each show is a sort of reflection of where I am in the year, I think. You know, it's almost like every show is like a sort of journal that I've then torn up and I'm sort of spending an hour dancing in the confetti of it. So it comes out in these sort of weird ways. It's weirdly expressed or indirectly expressed, but there's truth. There's little bits that are true. It definitely felt like a reaction to that. But some days the shows would be different. There'd be moments. Some days it was kind of dependent on the audience. Sometimes it was dependent on whether I could be bothered to go off road. Sometimes I just wasn't in the mood, so eventually it kind of solidified as it went on. It solidified into more of a structure than it was originally intended. But it was hard because I went to Edinburgh thinking, well, this show is not finished and it needs work. But then I just didn't work on it, and then I won the award and I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding me, half of this is shit. But there was obviously something in it that felt loose. And so I didn't want to rock the boat too much. I didn't want to start correcting it if people were enjoying it. So it had moments of spontaneity, and it's still every show there would be something new and different. It would just, I guess, like how different would be dependent on audience and me, the vibe in the room, I guess.
Matt Smith asked, how did you learn to cope with those excruciating silences? You know, the ones when someone in the crowd really isn't getting it. Well, I guess the question is there, do you cope with them? And if you do cope with them, how did you learn?
I love them. I mean, I don't mind them. I don't see them as excruciating necessarily. There's definitely been gigs, particularly previews early on, where, you know, if you get, I mean, I'm sure you know this, if you get it wrong, where you put too many... there are too many missteps early on, it throws the whole thing off and you're performing to silence for the next 45 minutes and you're like, why the fuck did I fucking say that thing up top or whatever? There's definitely a few of those where it's plunged into awkward silences that I don't enjoy. And sometimes if someone isn't enjoying it, I have got annoyed. And I think at times I've tried to sort of frame those impulses. Again, it's like taking those impulses and building them into the act. It's like, well, I would have a go at the audience right now for this, or I would have a go at this person for frowning at me. And the impulse is there. The impulse is real. I'm seeing it and I'm affronted by it, or I'm, you know, in some way rattled by it. How I deal with it varies. Sometimes it's in a funny way. Sometimes it's genuinely like, I've definitely made mistakes in the past where I've come in too hard at people. But I don't really mind that. I don't really mind the silences. I think there's a certain control in that. There's a certain control in just letting things hang, and letting people just sit with it. You know, it's an experience. You're not meant to be totally at ease the whole time. If you want to feel comfortable, if you want to have a comfortable evening, like make a hot water bottle and get an early night. Don't come and see me perform.
That question was Matt Smith. Thank you, Matt. This is from Richard Fogarty. When miming making out with a cat, did he have a particular real-life cat in mind that he used for inspiration?
Yeah, my cat Lucy. She's beautiful. She's a good girl. It came from, which is where most of my bits come from, which is me trying to entertain someone I'm seeing. And I was acting out a scenario where I would seduce my own cat. And it was funny enough, and I was like, yeah, I've got to put that in. But it was one of those things, actually, to sort of come back to what you were talking about earlier about me being uncomfortable with certain bits or putting stuff in that makes me feel uncomfortable. That's definitely a bit that was in the first show that I didn't even really like necessarily. But for that reason, it felt like, oh, well, put it in, keep it in, be uncomfortable with them, you know. Be like, oh, I also don't like this and I'm sorry I'm doing it. But there's a part of me, an unknown part of me that is compelling me to do it and I apologize. And it was a way of making it, if you're like, you know, if I'm miming getting off with a cat and I'm really enjoying it and I'm enjoying the audience's discomfort, that's less interesting than if I'm looking at them like, why am I doing this and I'm so sorry? We're all in it together. We're all a victim of my awful impulse. So that stuff sort of stays in because it's kind of funny, I guess.
But it's that's a great answer. I'm really glad we got to that. That because that's, you know, those must be the bits I think that lots of people watching you find hardest to imagine what it would be like to be doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
So actually the fact of that, it absolutely is more interesting seeing you have a genuine problem with it. Presumably there's the danger there of that being a kind of an endless series of sort of rabbit holes to you when you're directing or planning your show, that you're thinking, oh, well, if I hate this bit, maybe that's good. You know what I mean? Like, if I think this bit isn't good enough for the show, maybe that's good. You know, does that, like, is there a danger there that you lose your way with it and you kind of lose your authorial voice?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's definitely what I've Got Nothing was a bit of, was me going, this is it, really. This is what you like. This is good enough for you. Because there were bits in there that I wouldn't have carried on with if people hadn't laughed at or, you know... But again, that's just fascinating to me. That's just fascinating. And to lose your... And I guess this is something that I sort of learned from, like, you know, like being interested in kind of like clowning and the more physical side of it and the more playing with atmosphere, to relinquish your control over the audience and kind of go, I'm just a human being. I'm not in control here. I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm not the authoritative voice here, is really interesting. And once you sort of let go of why the audience finds you funny, there's something very freeing about that. I think comedy is very, you know, the idea or the sort of very old stale idea of stand-up is that it's very us versus them, it's performer versus audience, and you're constantly trying to, you know, constantly doing crowd control, you're constantly trying to reassert your funniness and, you know, and your right to be the loudest voice in the room. But if you go on stage and go, no, I don't know. It's just more interesting to me.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for having me.
So that was Jordan. Do not miss out on those extras. 35 minutes of extra stuff at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, as well as access to all of the insiders content, all of the extra bits from every episode that has it, which is over 100 hours now, I think. So certainly worth your money. Also, do not miss out on going to jordanbrookscomedy.com and downloading I've Got Nothing and Bleed. I've not done the download version of Bleed, and I don't know how it's designed with the sort of unique headphones element, but you should find out and you should definitely buy it and support him because he's excellent. So that is all for now. Thanks once again to Jordan, to Rob Smouton for the music. The logging was by Jake Crossland. Your podcast consultant is Peter Dobbing, and Nathan Wood edited this episode and uploaded it and produced it and did like everything else. Loads more great interviews coming up soon. It's a pleasure to be back. I will post-amble at you about that in just a moment, but for now, that concludes the podcast. So, this is take two of an attempt at a post-amble, but it's been a while and I am rusty. And also, I ended up sort of whiffling about therapy, which no one needs to hear at the moment. Let's just find out about you. And I hope you've had a good Christmas and a good break and a good January. It's February the 1st as I'm recording this, and I am phenomenally glad to see the back of January. I'm doing lots of things. I'm also doing more homeschooling and more parenting. I'm parenting Future Girl while Boutros gets his homeschooling done. And I can shout out about this because you don't know him personally. He recently got a little award. He got a mention in Zoom Assembly for being, amongst other things, bright and resilient and chipper and working really hard. So I'm really thrilled with him for that. That's good. Christmas was itself. I can't sort of unreview the the last 6 weeks now. But I will say this, last Saturday, 2 days ago, I hit a wall. Do you remember? Do you remember in March last year when it all kicked off? And I think I released an episode of this podcast, which was like a special episode about resilience and trying to convince you that you are able to cope and you can cope. And I'm pleased to have been bouncy and positive for the large part of the last year. But Saturday, I hit a fucking wall. And all my mirth left me, and I became rather mirthless. I became rather miserable, and I just suddenly had one of those moments. I think everyone's had one of these recently, or continually. Just a moment of thinking, just sod this. I don't know. It could have been a couple of things that contributed to it. One was seeing some photos of people at a festival in Perth, I think, having, you know, doing wonderful comedy at a festival and going, oh yeah, that's happening somewhere. Or like some gig with 7,000 people outdoors in New Zealand. There we go, that's an island. They locked down swiftly and effectively, and there we are. And it's just kind of just losing, not the will to live, but losing will in general. It's tough, isn't it? So I suppose I'm just recording this to remind me as much as you. It's a note to self God, it's continuing to be hard. It's shitty weather. And certainly in the UK where I'm recording this, it's just, I've had days and days and days of rain. We had one snow day, one miraculous snow morning. And the just seeing the world afresh, seeing the world differently and going, it gave me, I mean, if anything, probably what I had on Saturday was the crash that resulted in the previous Sunday, I think it was, the previous Sunday's beautiful snow and the possibility of difference. And like, God, imagine if it wasn't the same four walls over and over again. So I don't know. Is that positive? Let's try to stay positive. I tell you what, mate, if it wasn't for the regular little bits of exercise I've been doing, I'd be absolutely all over the place by now. So let's all continue to cultivate little micro habits that save our lives. Woo. So let's all try to continue to cultivate little micro habits that will go on to save our lives. And tell you what, here's a little bit of therapy I can share with you. I found myself earlier on expressing this sentiment. Part of me keeps kicking myself for not learning Spanish during lockdown, or Mandarin, or some fucking thing. Do you know what I mean? Like having a tangible, always a really tangible thing. Shout out to the comedian who will remain nameless because I haven't checked this with them, but who's just started at school for electricians. I've got to continue to be completely impressed by comics being flexible and going, well, the circuit's been tough for a bit. That's a thing. Let's stay with this. Last year, in April, people were getting on comedy Facebook, comedians' private Facebook groups and saying, you know, has anyone got any ideas for short-term work? And this year, January, that was one of the things that helped break me, was seeing the amount of people getting on those same groups and saying, has anyone got any ideas for career changes? Because, you know, it is all coming back. Of course it is. And no one's going to get any less good at it. But, you know, people who've put 15 years into it aren't going to suddenly lose the ability. But it will be a while until the circuit in this country returns. Of course it will. So I continue to be completely blown away by the kind of grit and determination of everyone being flexible and going, right, dig in, learn something else, do something else. All of that stuff is really impressing me. So well done, everyone, doing that. And I suppose, what am I saying? That's it, micro habits. I keep thinking I should learn Spanish, but here's a habit I should be building up. I should be practicing little micro habits of compassion and little micro habits of self-compassion and stop having such a fucking go at myself. In short form, I've been made aware through this therapy recently of the absolute vastness, the colossal sort of architecture of how badly I can treat myself sometimes. Andrew O'Neill on Facebook posted something similar. Artists, stop giving yourself a hard time. And it was in a similar sort of vein. But what's been really reverberating throughout my mind for the last couple of weeks is just finally realizing, being aware of just how fucking hard a time I can give myself when I don't deserve it. And I think the conversation, I can share this because this wasn't a therapy thing. This is a conversation with a human being thing. Recognizing that our beliefs and our values are often different. And that specifically in my case, my beliefs and my values have been contradictory against. They've been against each other. My values are help, be kind, help people, make people happy, make them laugh, those kind of things, values. My beliefs are, if you don't do those things well enough, you're a piece of shit, Goldsmith. Do you know what I mean? Just recognizing like the difference between those two qualities. Have a little chat with yourself if any of this resonates. I would suggest that a great number of your values are positive. I would suggest you might want to keep an eye on your beliefs in case they are less positive, because I am unraveling loads of stuff at the moment and I won't go into any more detail than that. But this is definitely a time to be kind to yourself. So whether you are putting three juggling balls by the kettle and every time you make a cup of tea, you're teaching yourself to juggle, it's the best way to learn. Whether you're using that as a parallel and just putting little habits of exercise, I'm learning how to do a handstand, just spending a couple of minutes every day practicing a handstand, whether it's little things like that or whether the little micro habits that you are investing in yourself with now in order to, at the end of this thing, when everything is genuinely back to normal, you go, oh, by the way, I learned this in lockdown. Well, let's also incorporate in that package, or let's make the soul focus, whatever, the idea of having compassion for yourself. It is tough at the minute and you're doing great.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.